The years 1992 and 1993 marked the beginning of what Cash would later call his third career, or his second comeback. His first career started with Hey Porter in 1955, and Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison signified his first comeback in 1968. Comfortable and enjoying himself in the 1980s, his Best Of album, The Mercury Years, boasts some terrific tracks recorded between 1987 and 1991, including Cats in the Cradle, 16 Tons, and I'd Rather Have You. But he wasn't jumping any artistic hurdles. Neither was he winning over a new generation of listeners, as Roy Orbison did with his 1988 album, Mystery Girl. Cash had yet to make his comeback album. He'd reached the point where people admired him more for his past achievements than for his present output. He received a Living Legends Award at the Grammy Awards Ceremony, 1991, and was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, 1992, at a time when he was playing small venues like Rhodey's Roadhouse in Mississauga, Ontario, and Toad's Place at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Only with the Highwaymen did he now play the large arenas and have an impact on the charts. Highwaymen had topped the country singles charts, and both Highwaymen albums had made it into the top 100 of the Billboard charts. After a second U.S. tour in 1990, the group toured Australia and New Zealand in 1991 and then Europe in 1992. Cash's dwindling status, coupled with the frustrations of touring with a variety of health problems, may have clouded his judgment when it came time to commit to Cash Country, a planned $35 million entertainment complex in Branson, Missouri. The music theme park, spread over 100 acres, would include three theaters, a horse arena, a go-kart track, an amusement park, a water park, an auction house, a Cash museum, a 35-unit hotel, three motels, and a 20,000-square-foot shopping mall. The guaranteed 75 nights a year in one of the 2,500-seat theaters appealed to Cash, and Branson was only 400 miles from Nashville. Veterans Roy Clark and Mel Tillis already had long seasons in Branson. "It's not running away from Nashville," said Lou Robin. "It's just part of the road activity he does 100 days a year. There comes a time after 36 years that you look for an easier way to do it. In Branson, we'll work 5 days at a time, essentially every other week. The rest of the time, we'll be doing other things." Cash never put any money into the project being designed and built by California property developer David Green, but he did allow his name to be used and was promised that he and June would be given some creative input. Cash wanted one of the theaters to be devoted to gospel music, and June had ideas about developing shows for children. The museum would be modeled on the existing Cash Museum at House of Cash, which opened in March 1979 at a cost of $10 million, and would include separate sections devoted to different aspects of Cash's life, from music and history, to patriotism and Americana, to causes like prisons, guns, and Native Americans. With the opening date scheduled for May 1992, it looked like the ideal way for Cash to celebrate his 60th birthday. But Cash Country didn't open on May 1, 1992, with a headline show by Johnny Cash as announced. By the spring, cash flow problems forced the builders to stop work. November found David Green in a Springfield, Missouri bankruptcy court where the judge approved a $4.1 million sale of the half-completed theater. The failure of Cash Country drastically altered the shape of the final decade of Cash's career. Had it taken off, he may well not have embarked on the European tour in January 1993 that took him to Dublin on February 8th. If he hadn't gone to Dublin, he wouldn't have sung on a track for U2's album Europa, which, as time would tell, became a turning point in his career. Although a monumental figure assured his place in the history of 20th century popular music, it had been years since Cash had been considered hip. Not since 1968 to 1970, when he was cutting the prison albums and introducing people like Bob Dylan, James Taylor, and Joni Mitchell to the television viewing public, had his influence really mattered. Then, starting in 1988, a reevaluation began to take place. The first indication was a Johnny Cash tribute album, made in Britain to raise money for an AIDS charity. Till Things Are Brighter, produced by Mark Riley and John Langford for Red Rhino Records, featured members of some of Britain's more avant-garde post-punk bands, That Petrol Emotion, Cabaret Voltaire, The Mekons, The Triffids, and Soft Cell. It was a fascinating link between Cash and the world of alternative rock. Mark Riley explained, "Generally speaking, for the young audience in Britain, The country and western singers are pretty much figures of fun, but Johnny Cash comes across as this cool dude who plays in prisons and wears black. Everybody was instantly keen to do it. That same year, Cash met Bono, who came to Hendersonville during a driving trip across America with U2 bass player Adam Clayton. When they sat down for a meal, Cash intoned a long and elaborate grace, thanking God for his wonderful provisions and asking him to bless the food to their bodies. Then he opened his eyes, winked at Bono, and said, "Sure do miss the drugs, though." The demonstration of piety coupled with the admission of weakness endeared Cash to the young Irish musicians. In May 1989, Cash recalled the meeting. "We sat around and played some songs afterwards and then started writing a song together, Ellis Island, which was never completed. We were going to finish it off by fax, but that didn't work out. I hope to go and see him when I get to Dublin." The early period of Sun Records fascinated Bono. He was interested in knowing the origins of rock and roll, and was also intrigued by the theological struggles of people like Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis as they fought to reconcile this deeply sensual music with their Pentecostal understanding of Christianity. Rock and roll encouraged rebellion, abandon, pride, and self-indulgence. Jesus Christ preached obedience, self-control, humility, and sacrifice. Was reconciliation possible? Of all the Sun Records artists, Cash was the one closest in spirit to U2. Cash was the one who developed a social conscience, placing his music at the service of the downtrodden and marginalized. He was the one unafraid to explore the darkness within himself. He was the one to incorporate spiritual material into his non-gospel albums. He was also the one to explore folk, blues, gospel, and country roots. For a contemporary band attracted to rock and roll, the teachings of Jesus, and political justice, Cash was a unique example. "Johnny Cash was a saint who preferred the company of sinners," says Bono. "It's an amazing thing. I've seen the Bible he read from. I've seen his life from various different quarters, and what I was left with was the feeling that I'd met someone with the dignity of an age we don't know. I feel it's as though I'm reading about Jacob or Moses. He was so not 20th century. He was a mythical figure. I don't know how that happens. Elvis, Johnny Cash, they were mythical figures and they lived mythical lives." In February 1993, when Cash was in Dublin to play a concert with Kris Kristofferson, Bono invited him to Windmill Studios, where the band was recording with producer Brian Eno. As Cash later remembered it, they told him they were recording a track that was part of an experimental music project. The day before, Bono had written the words to a song he was calling The Preacher. It later became Wanderlust, and finally, The Wanderer. It was inspired by the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes, in which the unnamed narrator systematically explores all avenues of fulfillment before concluding that everything is worthless unless people remember their Creator. "Ecclesiastes is one of my favorite books," says Bono. "It's a book about a character who wants to find out why he's alive, why he was created. He tries knowledge, he tries wealth, he tries experience, he tries everything. You hurry to the end of the book to find out why, and it says, 'It's good to work. Remember your Creator.' In a way, it's such a letdown, yet it isn't. There's something of Johnny Cash in that." Cash added the necessary gravity to The Wanderer. When he intoned the lines, "I went out there in search of experience, to taste and to touch, and to feel as much as a man can before he repents," he seemed to sum up a large part of his own life. "It's like a post-apocalyptic search," said Cash. "It's the search for three important things: God, that woman, and myself." Bono instinctively spotted one of Johnny Cash's unique talents. "He's got this great voice which loves certain words," he said. "I just wrote those words for him." Cash returned home assuming the track would never be used, but Bono called to tell him that it would be the final track on Zooropa. A Johnny Cash track on a U2 album would expose him to a totally new audience. U2 was the biggest band in the world at the time. The following year, Zooropa became a number one album in both Britain and the U.S., selling more than 7 million copies worldwide. Johnny Cash was, once again, hip.